At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Corporate earnings season is in full swing. You've heard the good, the bad, and the ugly. But what does it all mean for the economy? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. This is your Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 25th day of July, and we are in the heart of corporate earnings season. As we mentioned yesterday on the program, Apple's quarterly results disappointed, but today, Caterpillar did better than expected. Now, there's something interesting going on in this earnings season, and it's not entirely about earnings. Marketplace's Mark Garrison explains what the corporate numbers so far tell us about the economy.
Two-thirds of companies reporting results so far have beaten analyst expectations for earnings, but you're missing a big part of the story if you only look at that bottom line. Thomson Reuters earnings analyst Greg Harrison says the interesting numbers right now are on the top line.
Revenues are currently on track to grow less than 1% for this quarter.
That's positive, but barely, and sales growth is slowing. Harrison's analysis shows more companies than usual are missing expectations on revenue. 6 out of 10 fell short. Miller Tabak equity strategist Peter Buchvar says revenue reveals.
Revenue can't be manipulated where earnings can be. So the top line really reflects the environment that companies are selling into.
Sales for Apple came in $2 billion lower than expected, in part because of weak sales in Europe. Buchvar recommends kicking the tires of any company earnings reports.
You have to look under the hood to see what drove those earnings, especially if the revenues missed expectations. There are levers that companies can pull that could drive earnings without the same kind of revenue growth that they're used to.
Levers like accounting moves, but there's a more important factor at play for these companies, says Brian Westbury, chief economist at First Trust Advisors.
They are raising their productivity.
Productivity, of course, has a bright and dark side. Getting more done with less because of better technology is great. But another way to raise the profit per worker is to lower the amount of workers. So if companies don't grow their revenues, there could be job cuts. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
The American dream.
Millionaires, billionaires.
Class warfare.
Paycheck to paycheck.
We pay our fair share.
President Obama is in New Orleans today to deliver the opening address at the Urban League's annual conference. The civil rights organization is focusing this year on education and jobs. The unemployment rate for African Americans is nearly twice that of white Americans, and for young black men, it's nearly four times higher. From our Wealth and Poverty Desk, Marketplace's Shireen Marisol Meraji takes us to one neighborhood in New Orleans where unemployment and poverty go hand in hand with jail time.
To say there's blight in Central City, New Orleans is an understatement. Businesses have been boarded up for years, homes vacant since Katrina, and employment scarce. But ask anyone who lives there how many people they know in prison or jail.
We got Bucci, Travis,
which is my kid's father.
And there's an abundance of names.
Michael.
Oh, Lord.
And those are just from a two-block radius near the corner of 2nd and Dryades. Louisiana incarcerates the most people per capita in the United States.
Who else? Who else? Who else?
That list you just heard? A majority of the names belong to black men between the ages of 18 and 40, prime income-earning age. But they're obviously not working, and when they get out, finding a job is tough.
What happens when the church comes out and lays their hands on the problems of this society?
But finding a church in Central City to pray for a job? Well, that's easy, because they're everywhere.
This congregation and ministry happens to sit in a million-dollar community, but it's not the kind of million-dollar community that exists on the other side of St. Charles.
Patrick Keene is the pastor at Bethlehem Lutheran in Central City. He's referring to the Garden District when he says the other side of St. Charles, home to million-dollar mansions. He calls Central City a million-dollar community because the state spends about $5 million a year there on prison admissions.
Hey, boy. What's up, boy?
Reverend Keene likes to check on his flock during the week. Today, he's going to see Miss Lizzie Randolph. She's been living in a modest one-story shotgun house on 2nd near Dryades for decades. Her great-nephews watch TV and play in the living room.
You don't have money. You're not rich. You don't know.
Keene says this is a pretty typical scene. Grandmas and aunties watch the kids while moms work service jobs. And he says this is a pretty typical Central City family. Two of Miss Lizzie's grandsons, Michael and Travis, are in prison on drug charges. Travis left five kids behind. Miss Lizzie says nobody on the other side of St. Charles cares about what happens to the kids in her neighborhood.
This drug thing is just gone out of control. But they're not going to stop it because their families is not getting hurt. Nothing has happened to them. They're sitting wherever they're sitting and looking at our black kids mostly getting caught up in all of this for a few pennies, and either they're going to end up in jail or dead.
New Orleans has the highest murder rate in the country, and Central City is ground zero. When you ask why so many men get caught up in the drug game, the typical response is, what else is there to do? A local nonprofit called the Youth Empowerment Project is trying to fill that void.
I like to give a shout-out to my mom.
Yeah, I want to shout-out to my mom and my brothers and my whole family.
Kids at its free summer camp just blocks from Miss Lizzie's house were eager to give radio shout-outs to family and friends. The Youth Empowerment Project also helps young adults get their GEDs and find work. 20-year-old Michael Brown came for help with his job search.
I just came home, and I started looking for work. I tried to work at a coke plant. I tried to work at some shipyards.
He just came home from prison, where he served 2.5 years for selling cocaine.
But by you being a convicted felon, they hesitate before they hire you. So I'm not going to starve. I mean, I can't just sit around like, all right, I can't get no work. All right, I ain't going to do nothing. I got to provide for myself.
Criminal Justice Commissioner James Carter says he hears excuses for getting back in the drug game all the time.
You can't always blame somebody else for one's behavior.
Carter works for New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu and says his office is committed to fighting crime and high rates of incarceration. And he lists all the initiatives he's in charge of to make that point.
What's called the Pretrial Services Initiative.
The Ceasefire Initiative.
The Reentry Initiative.
Midnight Basketball.
The Saving Our Sons Initiative.
But the one thing he feels is missing from the conversation?
The issue of self-responsibility. Self-responsibility is very, very important to add to the mix that will ultimately also help to reduce the high incarceration rate here in this country.
Dear Mayor Landrieu, my name is Candace McMillan. As a black American product of a single-parent, low-income household.
Candace McMillan may have grown up poor, but she's an upper-middle-class contractor now. McMillan lives on 4th and Dryades in Central City, even though she doesn't have to. She believes that you can't fix poverty unless you know poor people.
You know, I would hear stories like, well, you know, my mom's on crack. I never knew my dad. I got three little sisters and brothers. I have a record. Nobody wants to hire me. Can you give me a job? Because if you don't, I got to get on this corner.
In her letter to the mayor, Candace McMillan writes about the countless mornings young men have shown up on her porch begging for something to do to keep them out of trouble.
It seriously disturbs me that people looking in from the outside sort of kind of just draws this conclusion that the young black males or people who are victims of the 50 million circumstances and issues that plague Central City have just drawn a conclusion that they don't want better, because that's not true. That's not what I see. I'm living it. I can honest to God tell you this. Every person that I've given a chance has done well.
McMillan understands that politicians want to make big, sweeping changes. But she says what young Black men in Central City need right now are jobs, whether they have a prison record or not. I'm Shireen Marisol Meraji for Marketplace.
And we've got photos and a slideshow at marketplace.org. On Wall Street, the Dow snapped its losing streak, partly on those earnings reports we mentioned earlier. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Ryan Holiday is a liar, and he's perfectly happy to have you know it. After all, the title of his new book is Trust Me, I'm Lying, Confessions of a Master Media Manipulator. Now, Holiday's day job is corporate marketing strategist for the likes of American Apparel, but the book details his side job as a source for all manner of media outlets, often on subjects he really knows nothing about. His book is an amalgam of media criticism and rampant braggadocio. Ryan Holiday joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So, Ryan, I understand that you were pulled over for a speeding ticket on your way in. Did you lie your way out of it?
No, I told them I was on my way to a Marketplace interview, and they actually let me off with a lesser ticket.
All right. I'm glad we could help you out there.
Yeah.
Will you be lying to me today?
I hope not.
Okay, excellent. Give us a rundown of some of the subjects that you have been quoted as an expert on.
Turntables, insomnia, barefoot running, and my favorite, of course, is boat winterization.
And do you own a boat?
I don't own a boat. I know nothing. I don't own a turntable either, and I don't suffer from insomnia.
All right, so what was your ultimate goal here? Why bother with this kind of thing? Were you bored? You needed something to do?
No, absolutely not. So I discovered about a year ago, there's this service, it's called helpareporterout.com. And basically, the reporter needs a subject for a trend piece. I'm promoting something. I say, I'll be your trend subject, and we trade. The reporter doesn't really have to do their job, and the source gets free publicity. And so what I wanted to prove was that this backroom arrangement left the front door wide open to all sorts of media manipulation. And so in about 6 months, I was able to deceive almost every major media outlet, not a single one fact-checked, not a single one asked, hey, why are you giving us this information? What's in it for you? I mean, look, sources have always been self-interested. We've known this. But we've almost embraced that self-interest and not asked what are the consequences of doing so.
What is an example that perhaps surprised you more than any other that you were able to get yourself in a publication talking about?
Yeah, the opening chapter of the book is about this marketing campaign that I did for a best-selling author who turned his book into a movie. And what we did was we created a national multi-city boycott and backlash against his movie, and it was entirely fake in its origins. And we did that by buying billboards and then vandalizing them ourselves and leaking photos, by baiting feminist groups to protest the screenings of the movies. And from these sort of dubious origins came imitators and real backlash. We ultimately ended up with denunciations in everything from the Washington Post to the Chicago Tribune the week the movie came out, which, as we all know, when people say, don't go see this movie, that's exactly what people go out and see.
You going to continue to try to work your magic through these sources, or are you done?
What I've been saying is, look, I'm not quitting the game, but I hope to change the game, because I don't think this is the way that it should be played, and I don't think it's best for the society that we live in that this is the way that it's played.
Ryan Holiday is the author of Trust Me, I'm Lying, Confessions of a Master Media Manipulator. I sure hope that he has not done that with me today. It's out now. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And by the way, multiple news organizations posted corrections after Ryan Holiday's book came out. Olympic host cities get a windfall of tax revenues and tourist dollars, right?
We could not find any significant difference. between the city that had the Olympics and the city that didn't.
The Freakonomics behind the Olympics. But first, let's do the numbers. Finally back in the black, partially. The Dow bounced up 58 points, almost 0.5% to close at 12,676. But the NASDAQ fell again, down 8 points, 0.3% to finish at 2854. The S&P was basically flat and ended the day at 1337. Just as corporate earnings took a toll on the big board yesterday, some strong results pulled it up today. Boeing reported higher profit than expected and said it is ramping up production of commercial airliners. Its shares lifted off 2.75%. Heavy machine maker Caterpillar added a lot more profit to its coffers today thanks to strong demand by mining companies. Its shares rose 0.4%. Bond prices fell slightly. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.40%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on durable goods orders for June. The National Association of Realtors releases its pending home sales index for June. And on July 26, 1775, Benjamin Franklin became the first Postmaster General of the organization now known as the United States Postal Service. Mark the occasion by writing a letter. I'm Michelle Phillippe. Where's that pen and paper?
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. By now, you're used to seeing those email marketing pitches promising that if you send in a couple of bucks, you may have the chance to win something really cool. Maybe an iPhone, maybe even a car. Well, this year, the stakes are even higher. You could be the one to win an audience with a presidential candidate. Both campaigns are blasting out emails offering a face-to-face meeting with a political or a Hollywood star in exchange for a small donation. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports on the year of the eBay election.
If email could talk, here's what the message I just got from the Romney campaign might sound like. Donate $3 for your chance to meet Mitt and his VP pick in person. Will you be that lucky winner? And the Obama campaign, it recently raffled off a meet and greet at George Clooney's house.
This is all about that whole lottery mentality.
That's retail analyst Patty Edwards.
For $3, I can support the candidate, and I might get to meet George Clooney.
Edwards says it's an engagement strategy honed to a science by America's leading consumer brands. And she thinks it'll work. People will keep reading the campaign's emails to find out if they won. Still, that seems like pretty poor payback when the chance to win, I mean the donation to support our cause, raises just $3 for the campaign. But Middlebury College political scientist Bert Johnson says it's not just about the money.
Often campaigns don't raise much more than 20% of their funds in small contributions, but having a pool of committed supporters that they can identify is very important. You're more likely to contribute more later.
But raffling off time with the candidate, like a Las Vegas timeshare, does risk cheapening the message, says Kathy Kiley at the Sunlight Foundation in Washington.
The candidates are allowing themselves to be sold as commodities. So I think whether the price is $3 million or $3, I mean, is this an auction or are we really talking about ideas here?
The campaigns clearly aren't worried. They're ratcheting up these FaceTime sweepstakes as the election draws near. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The FDIC estimates that somewhere around 18% of the U.S. population is what's called underbanked, people who turn to payday lenders and check cashing services, not to mention the mattress, because they don't have good access to the banking system. In Mexico, estimates are 75% of the population is underbanked. But as Alex Goldmark reports, a number of startups are using technology to bridge the gap between rich banks and poor customers.
The city of Chimalhuacan in central Mexico has a population the size of Washington, D.C., but just two banks. And that's a huge inconvenience for people like Eduardo Ramos, who pays a dollar each way to take a half-hour bus ride to one of those branches.
It takes me some 2 hours, because when you arrive there, it's the only bank, and it's filled with people.
The lack of bank branches is a common problem across Mexico, partly because they're expensive to set up. One report pegs it at $1 million apiece.
It's not easy to bring there the services, the products. It's very expensive.
Loreto Garcia is with Banamex, Mexico's second largest bank. Her bank and others are teaming up with tech companies to offer what you might call a branchless bank. The goal is to lower the costs enough to make it possible to offer services that meet the needs of most Mexicans.
A place where you can go in and put the $5 into your account or take the $5 out of your account, or $3 or $1, right?
Alvaro Rodriguez is one of the investors behind a new startup called Barared. It's devised a way to attach iPads to payphones and turn them into something akin to an ATM. A customer goes to a payphone, say at a corner pharmacy, taps a few buttons, and enters a banking request like withdraw 500 pesos. A companion iPad behind the counter beeps and tells the pharmacist to give the customer 500 pesos. The bank then reimburses the pharmacy. Rodriguez says it works for other transactions too.
And it says, what do you want to do, right? I want to make a payment. Electricity bill. How much you want to pay? 150 pesos. You click it, you turn around, go to the store owner. In his or her iPad, it says, collect 150 pesos.
Most transactions will cost about 30 U.S. cents, split between Barared and the storekeeper. In Chimahuacan, pharmacy owner Angel Martinez let me behind his bulletproof windows to see where the money will be kept for the new phone booth branchless bank that he's installing this month. He says he's not worried about becoming a robbery target.
No hay problema para nosotros.
It's not a problem for us. We manage our cash well. It's always flowing in and out, so we always end up with the right amount.
He can decline any transaction that's too big, so he doesn't plan to stockpile extra cash. He does expect to earn extra, though, because the customers I stopped here, like truck driver Jose Lopez, were pretty excited to be able to walk to a bank.
It's good. I waste more money paying for the bus trip now than I would in fees taking out 1,000 pesos. This would be really great.
Banks hope that enthusiasm for convenience will lead Lopez and his neighbors to transact often enough to build up credit histories, take out loans, join the financial system. In Chimahuacan, Mexico, I'm Alex Goldmark for Marketplace.
It's Freakonomics time. A couple of weeks, we're talking with Stephen Dubner, co-author of the books and the blog about the hidden side of everything. Welcome back, Stephen.
Happy Summer Olympics to you.
Happy Summer Olympics to you as well.
Thank
Looking
you.
Forward yeah. to it. Any favorite events for you?
Oh, you know, synchronized swimming, of course.
Of course, yes.
I don't, however, want to talk about gold medals. I actually want to talk about real gold, okay? The big economic boost that a host city like London is supposed to get, okay? But Tess, I'm here to tell you that, well, you can probably guess where I'm going with this, can't you, Tess?
No gold in them thar hills?
Let's bring in the economists, okay, to throw a little cold water and everything. Alan Sanderson at the University of Chicago has looked at previous host cities, and he measured their economic gains against what he called twin cities, okay, so nearby cities that didn't get to host the games.
So we use Madrid in Spain, but didn't have the Olympics. Or we use Charlotte, close to Atlanta, but didn't have the Olympics, and tried to look at tourism, construction, tax revenues, both before and after. And we could not find any significant difference between the city that had the Olympics and the city that didn't.
But, Stephen, how can that be? I mean, you have thousands upon thousands of people descending on these cities. How does that not bring in a ton of cash?
Well, it does bring in a ton of cash. So the Olympic Games, between TV rights and sponsorships and so on, are expected to gross more than $3 billion, which is real money.
Yeah.
But the host city pays a big cut to the International Olympic Committee. And then, of course, there's the cost of putting on the games themselves.
Mm.
And that is where things can get really funky, okay?
What are we talking about, though, there? Is this your standard cost overruns, construction, things like that?
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay.
But you also have to go even further back, and you have to look at the incentives of the cities when they bid for the games, okay?
Hmm.
So these cities, they need to send out two different signals at the same time. So to the International Olympics Committee, They want to look rich. They want to show off the amazing facilities they're going to build. But back home, they want to appear frugal, to show off that, you know, there will be plenty of money left over after they build everything. The friction lies between those two signals. So Andrew Zimbalist, who's a prominent sports economist at Smith, says that last year, the London organizers sent around a letter looking for economists who could produce just the right kind of economic impact study.
And in that letter, it said that we anticipate we're going to get a lot of criticism from the media and from people saying that we've spent so much money on the London Games that it's not going to have an economic payoff. And we would like to hire somebody to do a study that will contest that criticism and present a rosy picture of what the economic impact will be.
Yes. Can we please have a study that will show exactly what we want it to show? But, tourist dollars, not just during the games, but doesn't that play out supposedly, predictably, for years later?
Well, you know, keep in mind that a place like London, right, already has plenty of tourists. So to some degree, what you're doing is you're really replacing a Trafalgar Square tourist with a synchronized swimming tourist, right? And as Alan Sanderson points out—
You got a thing with synchronized swimming, don't you, my friend?
I am kind of fond of it. But Alan Sanderson points out, furthermore, that the idea of a local economic benefit is just much more complicated than you might think.
Just because a credit card gets swiped in a particular hotel or a particular restaurant or department store doesn't mean that the money stays there. It's going back. If you're buying a sweatshirt in Boston, was the sweatshirt really made in Boston? Was it made somewhere else? Is this a hotel, its central headquarters are in Boston or not?
Now, Tess, let me play devil's advocate for 1 minute. It may be that all these American economists are, you know, poo-pooing the Olympics because we haven't been getting the Olympics ourselves lately.
Right.
Okay, so New York and Chicago were the most recent losers, U.S. losers on Olympic bids. But if you listen to Alan Sanderson, he says that's okay because there may actually be more value in losing an Olympic bid than in winning one.
You want to signal something. Hey, we're a world-class city. And one way in which you could do it is to bid for the Olympics. Say it cost us probably, all things considered, $80 to $100 million to bid. But then you want to lose.
Okay, Tess. So how's that for your new Olympic spirit? I have the new chant now. We're number four. We're number four. Close enough to get the recognition, but we don't have to actually have to pay the bill.
Stephen Dubner, our Freakonomics correspondent, he puts out a podcast, too, and you can get that on iTunes and hear more at Freakonomics.com. Great to talk to you, and we'll talk to you again in a couple weeks.
Thanks much, Tess.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Novo Nordisk, combining drug discovery with technology to turn science into diabetes treatments. Learn more at novonordisk-us.com. Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And this final note, beware of magnets. The Consumer Product Safety Commission is suing the maker of Bucky Balls, those super strong magnetic balls that you can mold into fun shapes on your desk at work instead of working. Apparently, children are choking on them. The company has refused a recall, so the commission is taking Bucky Balls to court. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow jumped 58 points, almost 0.5%. The NASDAQ lost 8 points, 0.3%. And the S&P 500 was basically flat, ending the day at 1337. Our engineers include Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard. I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.